there would be established an Office of National Insurance in the Treasury Department, headed by a Commissioner of National Insurance, appointed by the President for a 5-year term. The office would have 6 branch offices and be funded by the national insurers. A federally chartered property and casualty insurer would not be subject to rate or price regulation, and there would be no requirement for pre-use forms regulation. However, with no change to McCarran-Ferguson, this means the limited antitrust exemption no longer applies, since it depends on state regulation to exist. The legislation covers many aspects of the business of insurance, including financial regulation, market conduct, unfair trade practices, receivership, and liquidation and mergers and acquisitions. In many cases, the National Commissioner is required to start with model NAIC standards. Under this legislation, national insurers still pay state premium taxes and participate in state guarantee funds, as long as they meet safety and soundness standards. National insurers must follow any compulsory coverage standards in state law and must participate in state residual market mechanisms. But states cannot prescribe the rate or price national insurers charge for this coverage. A national insurer must participate in any state-mandated statistical or advisory organization. An insurer that chooses to remain state licensed continues its rights and obligations in the state system as if the federal system did not exist. There would be federalization of surplus lines premium taxes, which is one area most everyone agrees on. S-40 is 330 pages long, so the summary here certainly has not hit all of the points included, but it does give us a basis for the discussions that we're about to have, and it's now time to hear from our excellent panelists that have assembled here this morning. You'll find on chairs in your row some question cards. We're going to be depending on the audience to provide us questions. So be thinking of them as I run through a few initial questions to kind of prime the pump. Let me introduce our panelists alphabetically. Start first with Neil Aldridge, who serves as the Vice President, State and Regulatory Affairs, leading NAMIC's State and Regulatory Affairs Division. Neil's primary responsibility is to direct state legislative and strategic state advocacy activities for NAMIC in all 50 states. In addition, Neil represents NAMIC member companies at the NAIC, at the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, and the National Conference of State Legislators. He serves on the Commerce, Insurance, and Economic Development Committee of the American Legislative Exchange Council and on the board of the Insurance Education Council. Neil is also the lead representative on the insurance scoring issue for NAMIC member companies. He participated in the drafting of the NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, model law, and has provided testimony to legislatures in several states and at the NAIC. Before joining NAMIC, Neil spent 5 years with the Indiana State Senate, where he served in the dual role as Director of Planning and Research and Executive Director of the Senate Majority Campaign Committee. Next, we have Deirdre Manna, who is the Vice President, Industry and Regulatory Affairs for the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, which she joined in 2006. Deirdre has over 17 years in developing and advancing state public policy initiatives affecting the insurance industry. Prior to joining PCI, she was lobbyist for the law firm of Dykema Gossett, and before that, she was acting director of the Illinois Division of Insurance, where she's responsible for regulating the insurance industry's market behavior and financial solvency, as well as providing legislative testimony on various insurance issues. Deirdre also served as an assistant vice president of the American Insurance Association, where she developed and implemented successful legislative strategy on various property casualty issues. She received a Bachelor of Arts from Drake University in Iowa. Third, Kevin McKechnie, Executive Director for the American Bankers Insurance Association, which is the insurance affiliate of the American Bankers Association, has been involved in the insurance policy debate for over 10 years. Kevin joined the ABA in 2001 after serving 4 years as government relations representative for the Affinity Services Division of Marsh & McLennan, the largest insurance services organization in the world. He's taken the lead on government relations efforts, ranging from the leadership of Health Savings Account Council at the ABA to the optional federal charter proposed in the House and the Senate in the 109th and 110th Congresses. And finally, we have Michael McGrath, Director of the Division of Insurance of the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. Illinois chooses the title of director. Most states would use the title of commissioner. New York would use superintendent, but here in Illinois, Mike is the director.
I'm called a lot of things, actually.
With his peers from Florida, California, and New York, Mike has convened the U.S. first National Catastrophe Insurance Summit. He was the representative of the NAIC at the International Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. He's also testified on behalf of the NAIC before the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs regarding renewal of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, or TRIA. He's testified on behalf of the NAIC before the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary and the President's Antitrust Modernization Commission. In both instances, describing the consumer protections and benefits of state-based insurance regulation afforded by the McCarran-Ferguson Act. In Illinois, Director McGrath is implementing a new medical malpractice rate regulation regime and guides the division's investigation into contingent commission payments, where he's negotiated national settlement agreements. At the NAIC, Director McGrath is chair of the Broker Activities Task Force and vice chair of the NAIC P&C Insurance Committee. Prior to his appointment, he spent 15 years in private practice as an attorney representing national and regional financial institutions. I'm really pleased that all four of our panelists have agreed to be with us this morning. And without any further ado, let me get into some questions that will help focus the debate. And I've said earlier that I think the best way for an audience to learn something about the subject is to have presentations from both ends of the spectrum. And we have it represented here today. So we're going to have some back and forth, and we look forward to that. So our first question is, do we need to establish an optional federal charter for insurers as outlined in Senate Bill 40, and why or why not? Mike, if we could start with you.
Sure. Thanks, David. Good morning. Those of you who are in from out of town, welcome to Chicago. I don't qualify as an expert because I live here. So I actually live within the 50-mile radius that David referred to earlier. But I did want to say I know very little about actuarial science, but I do know it takes a very significant professional and personal commitment to become a lettered actuary. And as a lawyer, and people give lawyers a claim for working hard and being committed to their profession, but I know that what lawyers do and the commitment we have to make is significantly less than what each of you has to make to become an associate or fully lettered actuary. So I want to acknowledge that before I make any other comments. Now, in terms of federal regulation, we heard a little bit of an outline by David, and I think I should first say that it's important for us to have a discussion about improving the regulation of insurance. Regulation of insurance needs to evolve and has evolved as the marketplace has evolved. And as Congressman or Chairman Ken Jorski did say, it's not whether we are going to engage in whether there should be a discussion about insurance reform. It's really a question of how that reform will take place. There's no secret, it is no secret to any of us in this room that there are differences within or among the states in terms of regulation. And in some cases, I agree absolutely that as state regulators, we need to be more uniform, we need to be more efficient. We need to be more uniform in terms of the administrative aspects, what I would call more the clerical side of regulation, licensing, when a company is acquired and a name change needs to occur, when producers need to be licensed, all of that stuff we need to handle much more efficiently and in a uniform manner than we do right now. There is not, nor will there be, a compelling argument for uniformity of rate regulation, by the way. But I do agree there needs to be uniformity and improved efficiency. And that really is an undertaking that began with state regulation back in 1870 when the NAIC was formed, and that process continues today. Not everyone will agree with that. But I think it's important, from my perspective, as I'm involved with the NAIC, to really believe that and to acknowledge that we are committed as state regulators to moving forward in a way that makes sense and is consistent with our core mission, which is consumer protection. As I view my two most important objectives as an insurance regulator, the first is consumer protection, and the second is to foster as competitive a marketplace in the state of Illinois as I can, or as we can as the regulator. State regulation is improving, and I'm not going to list all of the accomplishments, but we'll have time for that over the next hour or so. Deregulation of the insurance industry is simply not an option. And make no mistake, that is exactly what the so-called optional federal charter or the National Insurance Act would do. It would effectively deregulate the insurance industry. It really leads to optional regulation. It's interesting to note that the current bill has 330 pages. The prior iteration had about 290 pages, and an entire 15 lines of which were devoted to consumer protection. And this bill does not add any more flesh on the bone in terms of consumer protection, but it does at least identify more details about what can and cannot be regulated. And I think it's important as we talk about this to understand that this bill is a discussion topic. In a conference like today and the hearings in Congress, that's exactly what the big industry proponents of this bill want us to do. They want us to have these conversations to feel like there's some pressing need for change. There is not a pressing need for change. You don't hear and will not hear consumer advocates arguing for a federal regulator for insurance. In fact, the only consumer advocate who's really spoken explicitly on the subject is Robert Hunter of the Consumer Federation of America. And Mr. Hunter's position is that the real problem is that state regulation is not rigid enough because the property and casualty industry was way too profitable last year. So it's an interesting discussion topic. The biggest insurance companies and financial institutions in the country are interested in having this conversation, but it won't happen. And it's not going to happen for the same reasons it didn't happen in the 1930s. McCarran-Ferguson was passed in 1945 in reaction to Southeast Underwriters, which is a Supreme Court case in 1944. But understand that what happened at that point. 1930s, we had federal regulation of the securities markets. 1933 and the 1934 Act. We had federal regulation of the banking system, developed the Federal Reserve Board system and the Federal Reserve system that we have now. The National Labor Relations Board, we developed the Public Utility Holding Company Act, Social Security. Those are just some of the ideas. And in 1945, what happened? Congress, really at the back end of the New Deal, affirmed state-based regulation. And the reason is for a reason that every one of us can appreciate. We can live in the world of the business of insurance all we want. And all of you know more about the financing of insurance and rate setting and all that, or reserving, than I will ever understand. But the reality is insurance comes down to the single mother in Danville, Illinois, who gets in a car accident on the way home after dropping her child at school. And does she want to have to call the federal government when she has trouble getting that claim paid? And think about it. Do you want to have to do that yourselves? No. And the Congress people are not going to want to have constituents calling their offices when their rates go up or when their claim is not paid promptly. A couple points about the bill, and then I know we'll want to hear some. Kevin and others might have differing opinions on this subject. The bill, in terms of deregulation, a few things that it makes clear. One is that on the life side, the company only has to send the policy to the national regulator. It can start regulating as soon as that policy is received by the national regulator. On the P&C side, they don't have to send the policy to the regulator. They have to keep a copy of it and send a list of the policies they've sold to the national regulator. Choice of law provisions, meaning if there's a dispute over the contract, who decides what state law applies, because contract law is state law. The bill says it's the principal place of business of the insurance company, the main office of the insurance company, or the location of the insured, but it's to be determined by the contract. And ask yourselves, how many people are going to negotiate with Allstate about what choice of law provision they should have in their contract when they're looking for the cheapest auto policy they can buy? Ask yourself that. So we'd end up, and you understand the reason for that concern, is that when disputes arise, for example, maybe in the Gulf region, the state law of Mississippi or Alabama might not apply, but maybe the state law of North Dakota or some other state might apply. Last thing, rating elements, something that might be more close to your professional concerns. It's explicit. There is no regulation of rates and no regulation of rating elements. So what does that mean? Rating elements means credit scores, for example. The national regulator could not prohibit the use of credit scoring. And that discussion, at the same time, there are kind of these parallel universes, because while we're talking about federal regulation, there are states and Congress people, including Chairman Frank, looking very closely at the usage of credit scoring in rate making. The federal government is not equipped to handle this issue. This would be the largest expansion of federal regulation and federal regulatory authority since the New Deal. And our eyebrows should be raised when we have the largest industry proponents asking for this massive federal regulatory expansion. Federal government has not handled pensions, not handled savings and loans, and most recently not handled mortgages very well. And we can completely not look at FEMA and Arabian horse trainers as they handle natural catastrophes. But the reality is the states have done a nice job with this. We need to do better in certain areas. This is perfect indication or illustration of how regulation evolves. We're just at another point in that process right now. I look forward to hearing whatever comments or questions you might have, including those of my colleagues up here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. What I heard you say is that there are some areas where change should be implemented, but otherwise it seems you were pretty clear. No optional federal charter, please. Deirdre, what do you think?
Thanks. First of all, let me say that PCI, the Property Casualty Insurance Association of America, is really uniquely positioned to speak to the regulation of insurance issues and the issues surrounding this discussion. Our companies write 40% of the property casualty insurance in the United States. That includes almost 50% of the auto market, 40% of the private work comp market, 40% of the homeowners policies, and about 30% of the business insurance policies. And we support state regulation, but we'd like to see it improved. You know, this question itself is like asking if you're going on a trip whether you would fly, drive, or take the train. And really what's missing is the underlying principle behind the question. For example, when you look at regulation for solvency, the regulators over the past 5 years have done an excellent job in regulating insurance companies for solvency. We've seen a lot of innovative ways to look at companies, and regulators have stopped or really gone into companies and been able to make sure that they don't go insolvent, which is bad for the consumers. So should this be changed? And the answer is no, probably not. But speed to market, that's a different issue. PCI has continued to urge at the state levels, push for improvements, and we continue to do so. But little progress has been made there. It is still very difficult for companies to get their products to market quickly. And so then you ask yourself the question, does that mean that there needs to be OFC? Perhaps incremental changes, such as a federal standard, could work there. But the first thing that needs to be done is we need to identify what the primary responsibility of regulation is. And the primary responsibility is to ensure solvency protection for policyholders and other consumer protections. And really, the best regulator of a product in price is a competitive market like we have here in Illinois. And this market needs to promote competition and innovation in the marketplace. It needs to provide incentives for the efficient allocation of resources by consumers and insurers. It needs to attract sufficient capital to meet public demands for insurance products and services, and it needs to promote the availability of insurance products to respond promptly to marketplace demands. But is there a need for OFC? Incremental change, such as a federal standard, could work, but we really need to be looking at the system we currently have and seeing how we can improve on that.
Good. Thank you very much. Kevin, the banks are federally regulated. What are your
thoughts? We are, and I suppose I should, by way of disclosure, first of all, say good morning and tell you a little bit about the dark forces of the universe I represent, because obviously that's my role here today. And I should probably end up by saying things so incendiary that you won't have any patience to write it down on a card, so just blurt it out, and I'll be happy to answer whatever you've got. But I work for the American Bankers Association, and banks are now major distributors of insurance. We count several banks in the top 10 largest brokerages in the country. But I'm here not just as the ABA's representative. I also chair the Optional Federal Charter Coalition, which is the American Council of Life Insurers, the American Insurance Association, ABA, its insurance affiliate that I direct, the American Bankers Insurance Association, and several other financial trades numbering up to 12 in Washington, D.C. Cumulatively, we represent about 96% of all the life insurance premium written in this country, about 56% of all the property and casualty insurance premium written in this country. Neil and I will flesh out for you what all these numbers mean, because generally speaking, the majority of the premium favors some kind of federal resolution, but the majority of the entities favor some kind of state-based reform, a nuance that we can discuss shortly. But as I go through the reasons for having an optional federal charter in the first place, you look back at what is the macro picture? How are we represented? And we're always at an odds because you come and you debate an insurance commissioner. And we're not debating the insurance commissioner because you look like a very nice guy and you probably do an excellent job in this state. But your reach is only in this state. And that's the problem, because every time we have a debate, we end up talking to friends of ours. They are people who direct the committees in a state's legislature. They are commissioners in a state. And you come to the state and deference is due. These people bleed on the cross to get elected or to get appointed. And it's, as you described, a thankless job. How many names do you get called in a month, right? And that's the point. And so my point is there's 51 of these people in this country regulating insurance. And it's not coming out uniform. And let's translate it into an easily recognizable comparison. The ultimate disposable car, the chiclet of the auto industry, is the Taurus. And so imagine if that Taurus was different everywhere you rented it. Some places it would have an airbag and some places it wouldn't. Some places there would be 3 seat belts, not 4. Maybe they'd have to be purple. Maybe they'd be 5-point restraint harnesses, not just the simple click and go. Maybe the tires would be so big, maybe they'd be so thin. That's state insurance regulation. And it might have fit a long time ago, and it might still fit going forward for the companies that choose it. And very frankly, that's the thing that's missing in the title of this discussion. It isn't, are we going to have federal insurance regulation or state insurance regulation? The question is, are we going to build an optional federal regulator for those people that want to pay for it because they need the kind of scale their business model is trying to bring to the country and to the world? Right now in the U.S. Treasury Department, the Secretary has a proposal out asking the financial services industry, how do we regain, not preserve, regain our primacy of place as the global financial regulator? The question is, how do we modernize to achieve that in insurance for this particular audience? And what would you do? Think about the scale of insurance regulation right now. 51 insurance commissioners, most appointed by the 50 governors and one mayor. There are 56 U.S. jurisdictions, if you include the territories. In a lot of states, the rates are made by the Attorney General. That's true in Massachusetts. There's another layer. There are more than 7,500 elected state representatives and senators in this country. It's really, really difficult to get a consensus among the 100 U.S. senators. How hard do you think it'll be to get a uniform law out of a universe of about 8,000 people? That would be 4,001 votes to get, say, a uniform licensing law. And let's look at the history. The director talked a little bit about why we have McCarran-Ferguson. Why do we have this state regulation? Well, the PG-rated answer is because there was a Supreme Court case. Here's a story that might sound familiar to you. In 1942, after a bribery scandal involving the Missouri Insurance Commissioner, the U.S. Department of Justice reopened the question of federal jurisdiction. It caused the indictment of a prominent rate-making bureau and its member insurance companies, and it was at the hands of the Kansas City political boss, a gentleman named Tom Pendergast, and his choice of insurance commissioner over a $500,000 insurance claim. They both went to jail for it. That's been the singular achievement of the last 2 years at the NAIC. Not one of their members has finished his term in federal prison, which is not what happened in the previous 5 years. This isn't about Director McGrath. It's about the organization that represents insurance in this country. And guess what their tax status is? They're not a government. They have exactly the same tax status as the American Association of Nude Recreation, which is a very wonderful organization, by the way. But they're not trying to act like a government either. And there's a reason. They're not a government. And neither is the NAIC. And what we're suggesting by floating the optional federal charter and by representing the overwhelming majority of the institutions that sell insurance in this country is perhaps we should look at establishing a federal regulator that is paid for by the people that want to use it, that has the authority to enter into and negotiate with treaties with other countries, that is always left out of every free trade negotiation, that can do it at the national level. You've heard of all the things that the state system can't do, TRIA, flood insurance program. We're going to look at a natural disaster, perhaps a catastrophic defense fund. We're trying to figure out what to do in the Gulf. These are all federal questions. Are these questions something the state insurance system can manage or not? I think we've already answered that. That's why there's petitions in the Congress to answer those questions. Where would you take a petition like that if you wanted to answer those questions at the state system? You could take them to an insurance commissioner. And some people have, and your leadership's been noted. But what actually can be accomplished by one insurance commissioner, or two, or five? How many of you actually sold insurance? Comments were well taken. It takes a great deal to be an actuary. I grew up in Canada, and I played a lot of hockey without a helmet, so I couldn't possibly rise to the level of someone who could do the math. But I did sell a lot of insurance at Marsh & McLennan. I did it for individuals, and I did it for firms that had $3 and $4 billion in their retirement funds. And ultimately, the question of who do you call, what states can you sell it in, what are the differences, how long will it take me to get into a state? By the way, what states no longer are going to be allowed to sell the product in that I've already got policies in that I now have to go back and refile in? Who do I call about that? Because you sure can't call the NAIC. Most people start testifying in Congress about how the need for uniformity began in 1860, when the NAIC took off. There's great quotes in my blurbs here about Teddy Roosevelt saying the same thing. So it has been more than a century that this question's been debated. It's been debated by the government, so it's on time and under budget. That's why it's taking more than a century. I don't think we have that kind of time anymore because we've lost our seat at the table, folks. All the latest IPOs aren't being done in this country anymore. They're being done overseas in China and Singapore. Who's getting all their insurance? Where are you going to buy that? Bermuda? Lloyd's of London is insuring more banks than we're getting here. That's significant. I don't think that should be the case anymore. That's why I'm the optional federal charter guy, and I'd be happy to respond to any accusations you'd like to make.
Thank you very much. Once again, you've made your position clear, and Mike, I offer you a change of seats if the going gets rough and we need a buffer between the two of you. Okay, turn now to our fourth panelist, Neil. Do we need a federal or an optional federal charter?
It's a fair question, I think, to start out with. It's clear those Canadian winters froze part of Kevin's brain.
It's a possibility.
But nonetheless, I mean, the question about an optional federal charter, I think you have to look at two things. Let me start out by saying this. NAMIC represents 1,400, give or take, insurance companies. Every size and shape that exists in the country today, the very largest to the very smallest, national insurers to insurers that represent half of a county in Iowa somewhere. And so our diversity of membership is pretty broad on this. We have some members who, some of you in the audience, no doubt, who support, their companies support an optional federal charter. Our position on this, though, is that it's pretty easy for any of us to draft a bill that solves a lot of the problems of state regulation. That's kind of the easy part. But the hard part is actually getting it done in any kind of way that it makes any sense. We agree, frankly, with all of the criticisms those in the industry lob at state regulation. It's inefficient. It's wasteful. There are too many differences. Regulation, it too often is improperly focused. It's front-end regulation, not back-end regulation. All those criticisms are true, and in many cases, not justified. On the other hand, we don't believe that you solve that problem by creating an optional federal regulatory scheme that is unknown, untested, and will only grow over time. I mean, the one certainty in this debate is this. When a federal agency is created, it only does one thing, that is grow. It never becomes smaller or more efficient or less costly than it did the day it was born. And so we know over time, whatever system we create with this bill is only going to change and grow and create many of the same problems that we have now in state regulation. So our view is that we ought to reform the state system that we have. The criticisms are justified, but we believe in many cases they can be fixed at the state level. And there is evidence to suggest that that view can bear some fruit. States have begun to reform themselves in small steps. It is a hard, slow, difficult, burdensome process. At the end of the day, though, our view is that we're going to like the outcome 5 years after a state changes its rating law more than we're going to like a federal system 5 years after it's passed. The same dynamics that play themselves out in the Gulf Coast states when you have elections after hurricanes, those same dynamics would play themselves out in the United States Congress after the next election when you have a major hurricane in this country. Do we really want to have the same debate that happened in Tallahassee, in Florida this year, to happen in the United States Congress when we have a federal regulatory scheme that they can actually do something with? We think the answer to that question is no, because we think it's likely that they'll come to the same conclusions the legislators in Florida came to. And so now we don't have a Florida problem. We have a national problem where we have a system that is uniformly bad everywhere, and you insurance companies don't have a choice. Right now, if you don't like what Florida has done, you don't have to sell insurance there. You may want to. It may have been profitable at one point in time, but you don't have to. If you have a national law that looks like Florida's, unless you're going to start selling insurance in Europe and stop selling insurance in the United States, you don't have much choice. And we think, ultimately, those dynamics outweigh the short-term benefits that we could get by passing a bill that we would all agree in the four corners of a piece of paper is good and the kind of reform we need, but is unlikely, really, to be passed in that form, and certainly will change over time. And so we think that the longer-term view is to look at the state system, agree that it has to be fixed, and go about the business of fixing it, rather than creating something that's new and unknown and will only change. That's kind of our view of the world as it is today.
Thank you, Neil. Hopefully these initial opening comments have stimulated some questions in your mind, and you've got the cards. You've also got the invitation to stand up and shout.
I'm ready.
Throw something. I'll probably throw something at Kevin before this is over with. So
that works.
While Mike is collecting some cards, let me move on to a second question. Representative Konjorski has said that there's no real question about the need for insurance regulatory reform. The question is how best to achieve this reform. In your views, is this true? And if so, what's the best way to achieve the most important needed reforms? Who'd like to be first?
Oh, I'm not shy.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. His question is interesting. First of all, it speaks two things. There's an inevitability coming, and he's a federal United States representative. What tools will he use? Let's think about some architecture of law, because there's some good lawyers on the dais here today. You can do two things. You can pass a federal standard, and you can say, going forward, there will be no licensing in this country that does not comport with these criteria. And if, in fact, there is licensing that does not comport with these criteria, something will happen. What will that something be? The Constitution does not provide for something to happen because states are sovereign. So the only way that something can happen, if you have a federal standard, is the way that the National Banking Act worked. That created the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. It gave it preemption authority so that should a state decide it wants to implement licensing that is outside the criteria established by the federal guidelines, the comptroller would, or in this case, the insurance entity that's created, would have the authority to preempt that state's regulation. If you don't create that federal office and you do not arm it with preemption authority, the entity seeking the license must go to a federal court and say that state is causing us to have to engage in licensing applications different from what's in the federal law. And so the burden is on the individual. This is a real-world example because in Massachusetts and in West Virginia, we sued the insurance commissioner, and we won both times because under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act passed in 1999, the standard established was no state law that prevents or significantly interferes with the operation of insurance selling can stand. And when laws that required extra licensure for financial institutions that are still on the books in some states were not repealed or were not enforced, we sued and we won. And this is something we would like to evade going forward. If everyone in this panel is going to agree, first of all, that change is coming, and second of all, that uniformity is desirable, it becomes immaterial whether you think it should be the federal government or the state governments that implement it. What's material is that there will be conflicts. And who decides the conflicts? Right now, we live in a world where a court decides the conflicts, and it is on the shoulders of your companies, and the ones I represent, to go to court to ask for relief from a state that wants to do it. If you're a bank, that's not what happens. It's on the shoulders of the regulator in the state to go to court and say, no, my jurisdiction exceeds federal jurisdiction. This happened in Michigan, in Wachovia v. Waters, over the operating subsidiary rules, over what state laws an operating subsidiary of a national bank must adhere to. And the court decided that operating subsidiaries of national banks do not need to adhere to certain state laws because they are preempted by the federal authority granted to the regulator. That's what we're trying to achieve, so that this conversation is removed from court, so there's legal certainty, and so that uniformity becomes real. Remember, it's an absolute noun. You can't have more or less uniformity. You either have it or you do not. There's no middle space here. That's my 2 seconds. Retorts should abound.
Other comments on reforms?
Really, this is a very interesting discussion. And that is about all that it is or will be. And I do commend Congressman Kanjorski, Chairman Kanjorski, for raising this issue in providing a national profile for insurance regulation. I think that's very important. I think we've all agreed there are ways that insurance regulation must improve. The notion, though, of a federal charter or national regulator is a solution in search of a problem. What is the problem that we've heard identified today? And Kevin is very articulate, but if the nugget that I got from his comments was that we're losing our status as a financial leader. I think most people would attribute that more to Sarbanes-Oxley and some other law enforcement activities than they would to insurance regulation. But if we accept that as fact, I think we are looking at principles-based regulation and principles-based reserving, again, something most of you are more familiar with the details of than I am. And as the EU moves in that direction, I expect that state regulation will also look in that direction. But I think it's important to remember one thing, and I alluded to this earlier. Insurance is not about the biggest financial institutions in the world being as profitable as they can be, and it will never be that for our elected officials. It is an extremely local and personal and intimate commodity. It is not like buying a car. It is not like having a different tourist in every state. It is extremely personal to your particular life circumstance, and that is why in Florida and other states in the Gulf, it is an extremely political issue. It's not a political issue because the business world made it that. Charlie Crist didn't get elected governor of Florida because big business wanted him elected. And he didn't talk about insurance throughout on the campaign trail because big business wanted him to. It's because it is ultimately so important to the people who live in that state or along the Gulf that is how the leadership in Florida was elected. And that is why in the House, in Congress last week, they passed the Homeowners Defense Act, a bill that's based on an NAIC proposal, by the way, supported by the NAIC. They passed the Homeowner Defense Act in part because it's good public policy. It's not a panacea, but it is a step in the right direction. But they passed it in part because it is a political reality they need to deal with, that both parties need to acknowledge, which is the people in the Gulf have very serious concerns about their property and casualty insurance. So politics in that situation, that's an illustration of politics reflecting the priorities of the people. If you come to Illinois, those of us who live here, we don't have big public discussions about the property and casualty industry. That is, again, and I don't want to take up more than my share of time, but that again illustrates why state regulation is important. There are local differences, regional differences that have to be recognized.
Neil or Deirdre?
Yeah, I was just going to add that, again, when you look at that question, you have to ask, you know, what is the reference reformed? And I think there's a presumption here that the end product will be a desirable one. And when you look at community reinvestment, problems with flood issues, McCarran, the mandatory offer of TRIA, and fair housing, you know, all well-intended, but, you know, there were a lot of unintended consequences that along with that. I mean, I think one of the things about OFC is that it would give insurers freedom in rate and form, which would be true speed to market, but you have to look at all the other aspects of it as well and ask yourself, you know, what are the unintended consequences? The reforms that I, you know, mentioned, I kind of answered this question, I think, in my first answer when I went through, you know, what you have to consider in true, you know, insurance regulatory reform.
Yeah, it's my perspective is that there's distinctions here that need to be made around this. First of all, from Kevin's perspective, we hear a lot about uniformity, and we get the correlation to the banking industry and how it works in that system. And really, I mean, first of all, there's a fundamental difference between banking products and insurance products. One, the checking account that you open in New York City is the same checking account that you open in Chicago, is the same one you open in Los Angeles. The homeowner's insurance you buy in those three places, though, is likely going to be different. And so there is going to be, has to be, some accounting for those differences in the regulatory scheme of that product. So we need to not only evaluate the regulation from one industry that works as a model, you have to also take into account what it's regulating. And there are differences in the product that need to be accounted for when we talk about this. And there's a reason why there are 2,200 and some odd number of property casualty insurers and not 12 property and casualty insurers. If there were 12 property and casualty insurers, the argument for a one-size-fits-all federal regulatory scheme would probably be more, would be better. But given the geographic diversity of the country, the differences in risks that come with that, the vagary in size of the companies that exists, it's hard to argue that one regulatory scheme can account for all of that. And again, we argue that what would likely happen is this sort of approach that would try to force various requirements on all those insurers that choose the federal option that may or may not fit their circumstance. And so we think that's part of the downside to it. But as far as the reforms themselves, look, there are no reasons for there to be differences among the states when it comes to licensing laws. There is not a reason why a company who's licensed in Illinois shouldn't also be able to sell business in Iowa or Wisconsin or wherever else you may want to sell business. The defense of that really needs to be eliminated. There is, however, justification for solvency regulation to occur, or market conduct, the way a company behaves itself inside that jurisdiction, wherever it's selling business. Companies ought to be held accountable for that, good and bad. Those are the kinds of things that should be uniform. and should be reformed at the state level and can be, but too often we get parochial about it, and so those companies that deal in more than one jurisdiction get frustrated and think that, well, we need to have one system, at least would be one. We may not know what it's going to look like, but it'd just be one. But our view is that the kinds of reforms that states ought to adopt are achievable if we just go about the business of doing it and not defend the current system as it exists now.
Thank you very much. We've had three questions from the audience on the international aspect of regulation. And in addition, Mike McCarter had a question on this, so let me read all four of them, and we'll get the views on regulation from an international perspective. First is, how would federal insurance regulation compare to the European Union insurance regulation? Second, what do the panelists think about Solvency II, the regulatory scheme in the European Union? Third, how can the U.S. insurance regulators have a credible or authoritative voice internationally within the current state framework? And Mike McCarter's question was, international accounting standards for insurance are being developed. The International Association of Insurance Supervisors and the European Union are developing solvency regulation standards within a global reach, and the international considerations are driving reconsideration of reinsurance regulation at the NAIC. Does this globalization mean that a federal insurance regulator is needed to provide U.S. considerations an adequate voice in these debates? Comments?
All right, I'll go again. Here's my side.
I'm just going to defer to one of those two.
I like going first because then you guys can tell me what kind of frozen my head is and other issues. And it might be the case. But here, look, I hope by pointing out how many people are in the state system, you take away from that the fact that you cannot freight one insurance commissioner with all the problems of this system. He belongs to a trade association. I assume he's here to try to do some of that defense work. But if it were up to the Illinois Department of Insurance engaging in international discussions, I'm sure you'd do a very good job. And then we'd have an agreement between the EU and Illinois. And that would be just fine if everything happened in Illinois. But right now, the fact is we're a country with 300 million of people. They're a country, not a country, they're an affiliation of about 350 million of people, and they operate on the passport system. And so if one of their regulators says you're good to go everywhere. And that's because they've got some level of reciprocity going right now, but they have uniformity in some of the things that Neil pointed out, which is, you know, to his comment, I agree. Why do we not have uniformity in the three places that it makes so much sense and are so easy to achieve? And I think you're probably on board with that too, but again, what are your powers to actually do something about it? They're limited. Our powers are even more limited. We're simply petitioners at the gate, really, for these kind of reforms. But they've already got them. You get a license in the EU, you're good in France, you're good in Germany, you're good in Portugal. You get a license, or you get examined, and all of those things are uniform too. And that was Neil's point. You know, in this country, we don't even have actuaries, and I think it's 19 states. They don't even have them. I don't know how you do insolvency regulation. Maybe it's a back of the envelope thing. Just everybody meet at the Sizzler and just talk about what everybody's got going on, and that's how you regulate for solvency in a state that doesn't have an actuary. They actually have it. And so the first contribution that a solid uniform system makes is you're going to get uniformity right out of the gate, and it's going to be transferable across these questions of jurisdiction. Why do we not have someone who is empowered to negotiate at the EU? Well, the NAIC does have someone that their members send over, send the president. Now, this year it's Walter Bell, last year it was Al Iupa, and they've got lots of air miles to show you that they did go to Zurich and they did do all this work of negotiating with the EU, but it comes to naught because they're not a country and they're not a government. They're a trade association. And so exactly what level of confidence do you think the Belgian foreign minister gives to an agreement signed by Al Iupa, the main insurance commissioner? Almost none. That's why in the most recently negotiated free trade agreement, insurance was yet again left out, because this is not an industry that this country represents nationally. We just aren't in that business. And if you'd like to get back in that business, as we would, we're going to have to give someone in our federal government the authority to actually engage in that discussion. Over to you.
What is the problem we're trying to address? If it's international competitiveness, most people would argue that the U.S.-based insurers are the most prominent insurance companies in developing countries around the world and have the largest presence in developing countries around the world. If the question is uniformity of standards with regulators in the European Union or other countries, we don't have that uniformity, and frankly, within the European Union, there is not uniformity. That's true. Is a bit of mythology. There is some reciprocity among some of the countries within the European Union, but even that is very much in its nascent stages. And if you were to look at European Union and then Asian countries, or consider African or wherever else you want to go, there is not uniformity internationally. So the question, to get to the specific questions about principles-based regulation, principles-based reserving, I think one of the interesting things, by the way, about the bill that's pending in Congress right now is how much is left to regulation. And the principles that are effectively stated in the bill are, you shall not, as a regulator, deal with rate making or rating elements, all the things that cannot be regulated. Most everything else is left up to rule in terms of what actually will be regulated or how it will be regulated. So my point is, principles-based regulation is an appropriate direction. It's appropriate for us to look at that. I think it allows for it can allow for greater market innovation among some of the largest players in the market. Principles-based reserving, certainly, I think, and solvency, too, is something we need to embrace as an objective. The EU has set 2012 as its date for implementation. I think that's entirely reasonable and fair. I think it's a good approach. It allows companies to be viewed in their entirety, the risks for the company in their entirety, ultimately allowing them to be more profitable if they want to be or can be. I'm not sure that works for every company in the United States. I'd be interested to hear what NAMIC's reaction to that is. But these are important discussion points, and they're important objectives. The NAIC is much more than a trade association, and I'd suggest that might be why we get 3,000 company representatives at each one of our quarterly meetings.
Thank you.
There are red herring arguments on both sides of this debate. On those that are in my camp, those who defend and seek reform system of state regulation, the legislators particularly, probably the biggest red herring argument that they make is the premium tax argument. That we're going to lose the ability to collect premium taxes. States can tax whatever they want, whenever they want it. They may lose it in the near term. They can get it back in other ways. Yes, the premium tax as we know it today may be different under some federal regulatory scheme, but states are very creative in ways to find ways to extract money from people, and they'll find some other way to get it. The biggest red herring, I think, for those who are in favor of an optional federal charter is this issue. This business, if the best reason to create an optional federal charter is to have U.S. representation in international trade discussions, we ought to all find a different profession. Because, first of all, there are a lot more countries in the world than just the EU countries that all have insurance markets or are going to get insurance markets over time. The second issue is, if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, we ought to have a international regulator in the UN somewhere that regulates the entire globe, because there's no way you can account for all the vagaries in every country as it comes to insurance markets by just having a U.S. regulator represented at this massive table of the world talking about insurance regulatory issues. And if that is the best reason for us to have one, I think it's really missing the point, and don't really think it's an interesting discussion. It's, you know, yes, it's part of the landscape, but there are surely a lot better examples of reasons to have maybe some other system than this issue, I think. We can work that out without creating some new federal system, it would seem to me.
Yeah, PCI agrees with that. I think that we believe that we don't need a federal regulator just to represent us, internationally for companies or insurers. That's really, the NAIC is already recognized at the International Association of Insurance Supervisors and the International Association of the IASB. And, the question is really, does the NAIC do a good job of representing and what they need to be doing internationally? But they are already recognized, as the representative.
Let me add one brief story or little anecdote. You're at some of the NAIC meetings, right?
Yes, sir.
So I've been doing this job about three years, and one of the issues that's been on the agenda at every session, every quarterly meeting and interim meetings has been the topic of reinsurance collateral. And this is something where there are companies internationally pushing for uniformity so that we as states, in order to provide credit for reinsurance, would not require 100% collateral from so-called unauthorized or the foreign reinsurers. Now, this is an issue that's been brewing at the NAIC for about 2.5 decades. And one of my predecessors, one of Deirdre's predecessors, in the 1980s was trying to resolve this issue. And as we look to modernize regulation, I have been very favorably disposed to this discussion about relieving the collateral requirements. And so last year at our quarterly meeting, and I forget what city it was, but it was the December meeting, and we finally get to the end of the year, and we're getting ready to announce a big change. And you have to understand, there have been white papers written on this.
Right.
There have been all kinds of comments from interested parties, industry. The domestic primary carriers are opposed to any change by and large. We finally get a proposal, and we announce it, and the industry stood up and was outraged that we were moving so quickly. So my point is, as we do move forward and as the process of regulatory evolution moves forward, sometimes we encounter obstacles from the very people who are arguing for uniformity. So in my mind, that raises the question, what does uniformity mean? And that is why we cannot have a lower level or deregulation of the insurance industry. But we do need to talk about improving, modernizing, and continuing the evolution of our regulation.
You got us on that one, because the optional charter bill does remove the 100% collateralization rule. And so,
right.
This is a bunch of dysfunctional children industry. I got it. And that's why the challenges abound. But one of the things that is always so interesting, I'm 42, and so the debate on that one question was occurring while I was in middle school, and apparently will evolve until my children are in middle school. And maybe that's an appropriate time frame, I don't know. But we're back to this question of what are the competitive elements that need to get solved today? And what are the competitive elements that can be discussions over time? Maybe that's a more mature way to approach this. But think about how our companies act globally and what we're trying to achieve here. And tell me if you can't, do not come away from the discussion thinking that this country is engaged in protectionism. And the rest of the world isn't. And let's use Aflac as an example. They make 70% of their money in Japan, where regulation is national. So you can sell on all the islands. You don't have to get licensing different in all the islands. And it's tropical in the south, and it's brutal winter in the north. And so they have lots of the same kind of weather elements we do. But you can get one license, and you can approach one regulator. And that's true in a lot of countries. Most countries, in fact. And it's not true here. And if you look at it in a more micro level, what's great about your auto market here, right? I grew up in Toronto, so it's a sister city of Chicago. You're on a Great Lake. It's cold as hell. It's windy. We have different markets. Here's another one, Chicago and Boston. Did you ever try getting a car insurance in Massachusetts? You know, to your point about the 12 insurers, we have that example in this country, Massachusetts.
16, there's, I think.
16 now?
16.
Yeah. An explosion, relatively speaking. We actually had something at ABI called Off to See the Wizard Day, which is when the Attorney General in Massachusetts decide that he's had his morning coffee and he'll let you know what you can charge for your auto insurance.
Hey, where's Barney Frank from?
I think he's from Massachusetts. And so exactly this argument
right. What's he do? What's he do now?
This argument's not working as well for me as I thought it would.
Yeah. He's the guy that's going to pass this bill you like, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's why it's going poorly. But here's the story. So you can go to Massachusetts. That's the story. Wouldn't you rather have a car insured in this state? How many car insurers are there? There's hundreds, aren't
there?
We have
the most competitive property and casualty market in the country.
Well, then let's do this. If there was going to be a state reform on one issue that was doable, and we all decided, let's do that.
State regulation.
Let's go and figure out how to make auto insurance a competition among hundreds of companies for really good benefits everywhere in the state, because a Taurus is a Taurus is a Taurus. It only matters what kind of stuff you're driving it through. Then why can't we say 3 years hence we'll come back to this stage, have a coffee, and open the champagne? Hey, we did it. We got one thing debated at NAIC and it got passed.
Rate regulation, you probably know this already, is the holy grail
right
for the insurance industry. No secrets about that. And if we did away with rate regulation, I have a sense this whole discussion would go away. But the reality is, in Illinois, we don't need to regulate homeowner rates. We don't need to regulate car rates and many of the other property and casualty lines. And you can guess why. Those of you who, if you're rating actuaries or reserving actuaries, you understand better than I that we don't need to regulate those rates because the marketplace in Illinois can do that pretty well. But when you get to a state like Florida, which is the most graphic example, imagine if you live in Florida, and all of a sudden the companies are saying, we're going to charge what we think is actuarially justified. After, you know, and factoring in what we need to pay our shareholders and officers and all the other things. Imagine being a congressperson or a state legislator or a senator from that state. And what position right. are you going to take is better for your constituents? Rate regulation or an actuarially justified rate? When you have almost 1,000 people a day, or week, I'm sorry, still moving into the state of Florida.
You're right on it now. So why don't we focus on this one thing and get to something that we can take away? Because you're right on the problem. What has rate regulation brought us? It's brought us the inability to change behavior in coastal areas by charging market rates for the risk you're actually exposing the insurance company to. And so what do we have in Florida? 80% of their total real estate value is 0 to 3 miles of the ocean. And so I'm with you. If we got rid of rate regulation for cars, like they have in Illinois, we might get better car rates everywhere in the country. Let's get rid of rate regulation for homes, especially in Florida, so that people don't build million-dollar homes right there on the sand, and so that the cost of the United States Congress is lower, because what's going on in Florida should concern all of you. Private insurance market threw up its hands. We can't possibly insure a house on the beach for what you're telling us we can charge. So the state did it. And the bill you referred to in Congress was the state throwing up its hands and saying, my God, we better get the federal government behind us, and we better get them behind us fast, because if we actually have a hurricane in Miami the size of Andrew, we're going down the tubes. And we don't want to go down the tubes. And so this is the debate. This is the cusp of where we need to go as a country on insurance regulation on this one point, because it's about to matter to your taxes. You're going to go up if a hurricane comes ashore in Florida. If this bill passes Congress, Mike, we're all going to pay.
Mike, do you want to change chairs now?
No, let me just, I know David and Deirdre, we'll you guys probably want to chime in, but look, the Homeowner Defense Act, let me back up. If there's a hurricane in Florida or on the Gulf Coast, Hurricane Katrina, over $100 billion were pledged in federal dollars. Who's going to pay that? Who are the taxpayers? Is it just the Florida taxpayers and the Alabama taxpayers? No, it's
no.
Those of us who live in Chicago, those of us who live in Falkton, South Dakota, or Fort Wayne, Indiana, wherever we live, it's the average taxpayer in this country is going to pay several thousand dollars just to rebuild
right.
the Gulf. So the Homeowner Defense Act, which the NEIC supported and the industry opposed, would have allowed for regional catastrophe mechanisms, allow for as much pre-funding as possible from the local taxpayers, the local policyholders. Now, it's not going to cover everything in the event of a catastrophe, but it's better than what we have right now, which is me on the north side of Chicago, a Cubs fan, slugging through the winter, paying for to rebuild somebody's home who's wearing flip-flops and a halter top, drinking tequila on a sunny day.
Well, I mean, this debate, though, is exactly why we don't need to have federal regulation of insurance. First of all, that $100 million is going to be spent whether we have an OFC or not. We also had to ask ourselves how much of that $100 billion was paid outside of the insurance context, right? I mean, how much of it was bottled water and blankets and generators that would be spent whether we had a federal regulatory scheme or not, or a system of regional funds that would help back up the insurance mechanism. We also ought to have the debate about whether any of this ought to be taking place through the insurance mechanism. One of our primary arguments against a federal regulatory scheme or an optional federal charter is the socialization of insurance, where we end up really diminishing the risk transfer notion of what the mechanism is really about and really create a social program whereby we create mechanisms to socialize the risk across the boundaries from where it occurs. A federal regulatory system is only going to enhance that. We are only going to have the same debates about various other social programs that we have now in this country, but it'll be done through what we can we tinker around with the insurance regulatory code to achieve the social need we want to try to achieve. It's the same thing we do with the tax code now. And by having a regulatory system in place, the federal government, that is only going to be exacerbated. And now, you know, the regulators I know support the bill that's in front of us, but for us, it is really example number one as to why we don't want to have this system. Because we're going to socialize the risk. There's just no two ways.
Why you don't want to have what system?
I'm sorry.
I missed something. This bill is an example of why you don't want to
have an optional federal system or a federal regulatory structure.
Listen, I thought I heard you, and I thought maybe my head was frozen because, yeah. Here's the thing. Federal regulation didn't bring this bill forward. State regulation brought this bill forward. This is the system that says it needs help when it goes down the tubes if a hurricane hits. We didn't write this bill.
No, members of Congress did, though. I mean, though.
No,
you know.
The state of Florida wrote this bill.
Well, I know. Yeah.
The state of Florida wrote
There's
this
no
bill because they
the
can't stand
ideas.
The idea of going down the
have.
Tube.
Yeah.
And these people write all these rates so that they can say, guess what, it's time to pull the plug on rate making in Florida because we can't possibly get enough rate to cover the $2 million condo on the beach. That is a rational argument. What we're about to do under state regulation seems to me a little different. This is where we're socializing risk. We're socializing risk by saying, all right, if we're going to allow market prices, we're going to have some other mechanism to fill the void, and we're filling the void with government.
So the argument is because Florida socialized the risk, the solution is for the whole country to then do it.
No, I'm telling you it's not. That's the point. I'm telling you let's not socialize any risk. Let's make it market-based.
Now, let's at least be moderately factual.
That would really slow me down.
There is absolutely no chance that we are going to discourage people from living on the coastlines. I mean, everyone in this room probably has a vision somehow of living in the mountains or on the ocean at some point in their lives. Maybe not everyone, but 90% of us. The fact is people are going to continue to move to those areas. Mm-hmm. The Homeowner Defense Act does not provides a federal backstop after there is a regional backstop. That is different from what we have right now. Right now we have the states not doing what they should do, FEMA clearly another federal agency, doing a great job of what it had to do, and then the federal government steps in. That's you and me, regardless of where we live, paying the price. The Homeowner Defense Act regionalizes that exposure and that liability.
Next question, then.
Sure.
Apparently we're not going to agree, so moving on.
Move on before a chair gets thrown.
Question from the audience has been, under an optional federal charter, what's the impact likely to be on some of the smaller regional insurance companies competing against the really big companies that are operating under the optional federal charter, characterized as being deregulated?
Sure.
Also, what's the impact going to be on jobs with an optional federal charter?
There'll be more jobs in the federal government for this big agency we're going to create. But we'll
have an actuary, unlike some states.
I do want to take on the regional, small, mid-sized insurer question, because I think this kind of begins to pull the wool off this notion that this system is optional. This is one of the other, I think, arguments that we hear a lot from the proponents that, look, it's optional. You NAMIC companies, you don't have to choose to be federally regulated. You can continue the way you've done it for the last 200 and whatever years and maintain the system you've got. And those of us that want to have a federal regulatory option, we can choose it and go about our merry way. But really, we don't see it as very optional. And the reason is sort of twofold. One, I mean, there are some members of Congress that would look at you and say, when was the last time Congress ever passed something that was optional? So there's that issue to deal with, that what the bill may become over time. But really, let's assume that it is. Let's assume for a moment that the bills that is drafted is reasonably close to what becomes law. And there is two systems that companies can choose under which they want to be governed. Really, though, firms have to sort of bet at the outcome, at the beginning, what they want to do. There really isn't this really easy way to choose on a Tuesday to become a federally regulated entity, and then on the next Tuesday you say, you know what, we don't like this. We don't want it. It's worse than we thought it was going to be. We're going to go back to the state side now. So just think a moment about, even for a big insurer or for a small insurer, what that means. You're going to stop all of your state compliance work. All of the laws that you now comply with at the state level, you're going to stop doing that and then start doing whatever the requirements are for this new federal system. If you don't like that, you're going to stop doing that and then choose back to go under the state laws. If you're doing business in 30 states or 10 states or whatever the number is, how really easy is it to do that? Those costs then for small and medium-sized companies get exacerbated. The scale is greater for them. Those costs are greater as a percentage. And so there really isn't this ability to choose one or the other and then choose back if you don't like it. It really is a matter of you deciding which bucket you're going to be in, and then you're sort of stuck with it. And so the benefits that come with this optional system, the states competing with the federal regulator to improve the system, don't really happen because the companies that are we're supposedly attracting to these different systems aren't able to switch. And so we think that that's one of the arguments that it sounds reasonable to say, well, we can just pick and it's, you can decide what system you want, but we think the practice of it is really a different matter altogether.
Huh. I'm kind of on the other side, obviously, but I think the dominoes line up differently. I think they might even line up differently for you. As your worldview of regulation seemed to start with how the consumer reacts. And so I thought I would point out there's a reason why two small state senators are the sponsors of the optional federal charter bill, Sununu from New Hampshire and Johnson from South Dakota. And that's because competition is what's lacking in small states where there's so few people that so few companies are willing to spend the money necessary to actually get licensed in the state to go and expose their products to, in Wyoming is only 800,000 people, which is about the size of the average homeowners association in New York City. So why would you want to go and do that? And so on the other side is this idea of consumer competition, because immediately upon getting a national charter, you'd be qualified to do business in all U.S. jurisdictions. And so from the consumer point of view, I can see there's one argument where it seems to make sense. And so from the consumer point of view, I can see there's one argument where it seems to make sense. To Neil's argument, we thought a lot about that, about charter conversion, and it was made purposely hard Because the idea is not to be able to swap in and out of one system. The idea is to have to make an informed choice about where you want to be. And there's a point of war that I hope is outside contention. The bill was drafted so that a lot of the current law and the NEIC models become the federal law, and there's a 5-year cooling off period before the National Insurance Commissioner can make any material changes. And so to the question about what standard will apply, we thought a lot about that too, and we did not want to either create new law or have a time frame where suddenly the standard's different over here. But looking out 15 years, we'll probably see dissonance. We are going, you know, we expect dissonance between what a state should decide and what the National Insurance Commissioner should decide. And so now let's get to the point of the question, which was what would happen to a small insurer and a big insurer if they're competing in the same marketplace? And you can only, in my world, you can only imagine something bad happening if you think insurance is consumed based on price point. I don't consume insurance based on price point. I consume insurance based on the company's reputation for being able to pay, which is why I'm a State Farm guy for 2 decades now. They show up and they pay every single time, and it's fabulous. And so one of the collateral effects of optional national insurance regulation should be the diminution of Bob's insurance. Poorly regulated, poorly managed, poorly overseen, poorly actuated companies in favor of a gradual rising of this commodity of regulation. I don't know what your view is. I'm sure it might be a little bit different, but on that one subject, and a great deal of thought, not rhetorical, but actual expert,
real thought,
was brought to bear. And that's how the dominoes lined up for us.
Well, not to be a cynic, but
please,
somebody could look at the sponsors in the Senate, Senator Sununu and Senator Johnson, and say those are two incumbents who are exceptionally vulnerable in the next election cycle. And maybe that's why they are or ended up to be the sponsors. But that would be extremely cynical, and I wouldn't suggest that. But I think to get to the essence of the question, the reality is people can, in my opinion, most people will consume insurance based on marketing. And that's why we see, if you watch college football, it is absolutely excruciating if you're an insurance regulator, because you cannot get away from the insurance industry. And if you go to a football game and somebody's kicking a field goal or an extra point and the net goes up and Allstate's back there and their hands are in the net. It's you listen to the Cubs game and it's Blue Cross Blue Shield is the main sponsor. My point is, there will be major consolidation within the insurance industry if there is a so-called federal charter, in my opinion. And it is in my opinion that many of David's companies, many of the smaller and mid-sized companies, will go the way of many of the smaller and mid-sized regional banks and be swallowed up by much larger insurance conglomerates.
I'm David. He's Neil.
I'm sorry, Neil.
We're about out of time. I'm wondering if you each have a closing comment to make.
I'll start. I went last.
Okay. Neil, go ahead.
At the end of the day, I think that the question, though, becomes this. We have to have a dose of reality in all this. I think we all agree that states need to be reformed. We can debate about whether some federal system ought to be created, but we also have to look at today. This Congress and the next few Congresses ain't going to pass this bill. There's no way this current makeup is going to support an industry-drafted bill that has rate deregulation in it. Not going to happen under the current leadership of the Congress in this country. And so the debate really becomes whether or not we're better off as an industry gnashing our teeth over something that isn't going to happen over the next several years, or whether we'd be better off spending our time actually deciding to fix or try to fix state regulation in a concerted way. And our argument is that we ought to engage in the latter and actually then try to answer ourselves honestly in the morning of, well, we tried to fix it and it can't be done, and so we've got to go some other route. I'm not sure we've answered that question yet. And to our point of view is that we would urge everybody to engage in that debate and have some reality about the actual chances of this thing in the near term being adopted. Thank you all.
Thanks, Neil. Yeah. Deirdre?
And I'll just conclude with, PCI, three thoughts. We believe that the best place to start this debate is to first define the principles of a good regulatory system, determine what that system should accomplish, and then determine how best to correct the flaws in the current system. Thank you.
Kevin?
Well, I think we answered the question, because the last time I saw uniformity was after 1999 and Graham Leach Bliley passed, and the federal law required reciprocity in state licensing, but it did it at such a low standard that we didn't get anywhere close to a 56 jurisdiction pile. If we had just made that one change, maybe we wouldn't be having this debate now. But I'll close with an irony. One of the first times that NAIC model law would actually apply in all 56 jurisdictions would if it was passed as part of the optional federal charter and imposed, because they sure don't apply now. They're different everywhere you go. I'll leave you with that, and thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Mike?
Thanks for your attention to the extent that you've been attentive. This is a really important discussion, as I mentioned earlier, because it's important to discuss the evolution of insurance regulation. And it's important that we have extremely bright, accomplished people like those of you in this room, I won't include myself in that, but and the people on this panel engaged in this discussion, because there are things we definitely need and want to do better as an insurance regulatory system. The one point you need to remember, in my opinion, as you walk out of here, is understand that insurance is about you as a person. It's about your family as individuals. It's about the home in which you live and the car that you drive and your aunt who might live alone somewhere or your son who might be in college somewhere. That is what insurance is about. So while we talk about the need for regulation, it is ultimately the consumer interest, it is your personal interest that we're most interested in protecting.
Thank you. Before I thank the panelists, I want to have us thank Mike McCarter in absentia for organizing this panel. And then thanks to Kevin, Mike, Neil, and Deirdre for participating today. I think it's been really terrific and lively and informative as we hear different points of view about this decades-old question, state versus federal regulation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You too.
And Roger has a
David.
An
David, thank you very much, and our panel, thank you. Thanks, and thank join you. Me in nice thanking too. Our panel. And I do have a couple of announcements before we go.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, a reminder, we encourage all attendees to please complete the meeting evaluation forms. Surveys were distributed with your registration material, and your feedback really does help the CAS plan future meetings. Also, announcement about the social event this evening. As you know, we'll be taking buses to the Field Museum for a buffet dinner. We'll have the entire museum to ourselves from 6:30 to 9:30 in the evening. Buses will be shuttling between the hotel and museum continuously throughout the evening. Buses will be loading at the lobby entrance on Rush Street beginning at 6 p.m. Please remember to bring your badges. That's going to be your entry. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the day.